from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the hottest thing in Hollywood. It's a hybrid. This broadcast originates from the San Francisco Bay Area and from New Orleans, Louisiana. How does that happen? Volume. What a great week for American television. It's the first week of May sweeps, and we had Corey Clark, ex-American Idol, accusing Paula Abdul, American Idol judge, of coddling him on 2020. And then we had Pat O'Brien confessing his sins to Dr. Phil. All in prime. That's why God made prime time, ladies and gentlemen. But apropos of the ABC 2020 expose of American Idol, the ABC broadcast prompted a statement from Fox. Hey, that's family. Expressing, quote, concerns about the motives behind last night's purported news special, unquote. Fox concerned about the motives of what purported to be a news special on ABC. No such concerns were expressed by Fox, I should note, when they aired in response to ABC's Living with Michael Jackson documentary a couple of years ago, a Michael Jackson-produced rebuttal on Fox, paid for by Michael Jackson. Fox had no concern about the motives of that purported news special, but hey, it's family. Speaking of which, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not the only one who thinks NPR isn't considering all things anymore. Bob Edwards, the longtime host of Morning Edition, says he's still getting static from his former employer. Edwards is furious because NPR barred his old colleague Scott Simon, host of Weekend Edition, from appearing on Edwards' XM satellite radio show to promote Simon's book. He's ticked off because a guy doesn't come on his show to promote a book. Imagine that, ladies and gentlemen. Quote, this is clearly just pettiness directed at me, Edwards said to the Washington Post. It baffles me that they're going to these petty extremes, especially when I'm still an outspoken supporter of public radio and NPR specifically, unquote. Well, that'll teach you, Bob. NPR says there's a policy against its talent appearing on competitive shows. Says spokeswoman Andy Sporkin, we see as competitive any host or anchor getting on any other talk show. Scott, stop promoting your book, apparently, according to the policy. Mine is the only program that Scott is banned from being on, Edwards said. No, that's not true. I've banned him from this program. Reached in Los Angeles on the early leg of his book tour, Simon was loath to enter the fray. All I can say is that the appearance was set up. No, sorry. All I can say is that the appearance was set up and then it was canceled or maybe postponed. Maybe it will be considered at another time. Said commentator Daniel Shore, awakened to hear the news. I was surprised to hear they said no to Scott, but at the same time they said yes to Susan Stamberg appearing on Bob Edwards' show. I find it all a little weird. I shrug my shoulders and say, quote, what's going to happen next? Unquote. Daniel Shore. I'll tell you what's going to happen next, Dan. The apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Dateline Washington, the Senate's top Democrat, Harry Reid of Nevada, called President Bush a loser just about the time Air Force One was touching down on foreign soil. Reid immediately called the White House to express regret. The remark violated the restraint that the opposition party customarily exercises when the president is abroad, except when the president was Bill Clinton. Aides said Reid realized right away he had overstepped when he said, quote, the man's father is a wonderful human being. I think this guy is a loser, unquote. He first tried to call Chief of Staff Andrew Card, but when he could not reach him because the presidential party had headed to bed, the senator talked to Karl Rove. And he told the newspaper he had apologized for what he said. U.S. Representative from New Mexico, Steve Pierce, has apologized for an opinion column submitted to New Mexico newspapers that carried his name, but was actually taken from another source. Pierce said he did not know the column was not original, and that the staff member who prepared it has quit. That is to say, it was plagiarized from somebody other than somebody on his staff. Runaway bride Jennifer Wilbanks offered her deep and sincere apology and asked forgiveness for taking so much time on cable news. No, sorry, for the trouble she caused by faking her abduction. Her apology was not made in person. Instead, it came from her pastor, the Reverend Tom Smiley of Lakewood Baptist Church in Gainesville, at a news conference. He said Wilbanks was too fragile and emotional to appear before the media, and invited people to watch for her on Larry King sometime soon. One of the Prince of Wales' favorite clerics has apologized to conservative party head in Britain, Michael Howard, after making an anti-Semitic remark in a pub about the conservative leader. Reverend Christopher Mulholland, a rector near Prince Charles's home in Gloucestershire, said, quote, "I always say I couldn't trust a man who has not tasted pork," unquote. The comment deeply upset both Jewish and Muslim leaders. The clergyman said he was sorry and had written to Mr. Howard to apologize. Howard is Welsh and Jewish. And in a related subject, the host of the German Opera tennis tournament, the German Open tennis tournament, apologized after a program published for the event described the host club as enjoying a golden age after Jewish members were expelled by the Nazis. Illustrated with a photograph of the head of the Luftwaffe, Hermann Göring, watching a match, the article has scandalized the Qatar Total Women's Tournament, sponsored by the nation of Qatar, formerly called Qatar. The article said the flight of Jewish tennis players from Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 40s only led to a brief drop in membership and that it ushered in the club's best years. The club's chairman said the organizers of the tournament were responsible for the publication, and he apologized for them. And in a still-related subject, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, a U.S.-based animal rights group, apologized this week for its 2003 Holocaust on Your Plate campaign against meat consumption, reiterating the belief that human suffering is equivalent to the suffering of animals. In a statement emailed to the Jewish press and Jewish rights groups to coincide with Holocaust Remembrance Day, PETA President Ingrid Newkirk explained that the, quote, "Holocaust on Your Plate campaign meant to show that the logic and methods employed in factory farms and slaughterhouses are analogous to those used in concentration camps." She went on to write that, "We realize that many people, Jews and non-Jews alike, cannot see through the pain and horror of what was done to human beings to agree," but she apologized. And there'll be more apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, we're bifurcating the feature this week. There are two special things that happened during the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival among all the great performances that you get to see. There are opportunities to see performers with each other in combinations that don't exist at any other time of the year. And then there are opportunities to see performers shorn of their bands.
Working without a net.
Working without that net. And last night, as we're recording this, one of those opportunities afforded itself to see Marsha Ball, who tours about 300 nights a year with a fine band, playing a piano night where it was Marsha and her piano on stage, and we're sort of replicating that experience here today. Marsha, welcome.
Thank you.
You don't play like a girl.
I tore up a piano one time. Actually, I didn't really, but the sound man, the guy who rented it to us, said I did. And he said, "Oh, 20 keys were broken when I got it back." And I said, "Well, be sure and tell him a chick played it." To me, I think guys play a lot harder than I do. I mean, I think I'm pounding on a piano and getting maximum volume, and then a guy comes along and just sets his hands on the keys, and the whole case
rattles.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you do just fine. How long you been doing this, Marsha?
Well, I was in lessons when I was five, but I think I probably was one of those kids that toddled up and tried to reach the keys. And some kids are that way, mm-hmm. and others can ignore the keyboard. But there were pianos in my grandmother's house, in my aunt's house, and I'm not sure when we got the one at my house, pretty much when I started taking lessons, I think. And I stayed in piano lessons until I was 14, and, you know, it wasn't serious stuff. It was a small town. She was a devoted teacher teaching a bunch of kids the same way that the dance teacher in town never really expected anybody to go with Balanchine, you know.
doing God's work out in the provinces.
That's right.
This is Vinton?
Vinton, Louisiana, yes.
Which is where?
On the state line of Texas and Louisiana, and in a hotbed of music. And there was so much music in the air, and of course on the radio, and there was so much piano to hear beyond what we heard in our house, my grandmother's ragtime and my aunt's beautiful 40s cocktail music, and she was quite the player. But there was Fats Domino on the radio, and the Boogie Kings in the Catholic Hall across the street from us, all things I've written about, actually, in songs. Music and Cajun music, Zydeco, country and Western, all around.
Hmm.
Music in the air.
And this is an area where people are now coming across the Texas border to go gamble in Louisiana, right?
Amazing. No irony in the fact that the as soon as you cross the border, the highway turns to crap, you know. But they're going gamble, and all this money is supposed to, you know, go into the schools and the roads. But yes, they do. They always came over, though. Let me say, they always came across the state line because it was always more to do in Louisiana. It's still the same way than there was in any bordering state.
Mm.
Texas, Mississippi, Arkansas. You could always go to Louisiana and drink, dance, party, gamble, cockfight. Whatever your pleasure.
All of life's pleasures.
Right.
Yeah. When did you first venture into New Orleans?
My grandmother lived here. So from before my memory, we spent holidays, vacations, and a lot of time here. And I had two aunts living in Thibodaux, Louisiana. One and then another. So we were down there a lot. But we always came to New Orleans. And one of my aunts, the one that lived here all her life, really loved music. And she loved New Orleans music. She would go into the hood and buy the records. And I can remember when Corina Corina was my favorite song.
Mm.
Based on, I'm sure not hearing it over on my side of the state, but definitely hearing it here.
And when did you first get up on a stage and perform?
I didn't sing until I got to college. And, you know, there were piano recitals and little school things, but there was not a lot of opportunity in my growing up to do any kind of performance like that. I think I was probably on stage from the moment I woke up in the morning until I went to bed at night, judging from the fact that my mother called me Tallulah about half the time. I met someone in college that needed a singing partner, and Shelley Carter, and she taught me to sing harmony with her on folk music, and I had my little guitar, and that's really the first time. And we did things like the Catholic Student Center. We went out actually to St. Gabriel and played a gig when I was still at LSU. But pretty soon after that, I met the musicians in Baton Rouge. I met the hippies, the musicians. I was a dropout. I was in a band. Poof. There I went.
Yeah. That's what they warn us against.
That's right. I fell in with the wrong crowd.
Yeah.
And now look at me.
And now you're leading the wrong crowd. Before we go any further, I'd love to hear you play something.
Okay. Well, here's a song I should have played last night. I thought of it when I got home. And it's kind of about all that stuff we were talking about a little bit. It's called Sparkle Paradise.
Mm.
There's a place down on it's actually on the Texas side of the line that was a longtime honky-tonk. On the riverside, down among the trees, you could hear that music on the Louisiana breeze. And the lights would shine out through the night. It was heaven, a sparkle paradise. Well, it sounded like angels singing to me. I was just a girl, maybe 17, maybe not, when I got inside. It was heaven, a sparkle paradise, and the moon would make strange shadows on the wall of the smoky neon people in the halls. Yeah.
An April 16th article in Section A about tensions between Kosovo's ethnic groups said Ramush Haradinaj, the former prime minister of the Serbian province, had pleaded guilty to 37 counts of war crimes against Serbs. He pleaded not guilty. The chart accompanying a story about local radio ratings in the April 26th calendar section mistakenly listed KCBS-FM as an AM station. An article in Wednesday's California section about the new president of United Teachers Los Angeles said A.J. Duffy was the first to move from the classroom to the top union job. He's the fourth. A review in Monday's calendar section of the Coachella Valley Music and Arts Festival referred to rapper Buck 65 and misspelled his name as B-F-E-A-R-U-C-K. A story in Tuesday's calendar on the opening of shops at the new Wynn Las Vegas Hotel quoted shopper Lisa Tenner as saying she had purchased a $5,000 solar globe at the LVNV store. Tenner actually said she spent $5,000 at the store, $500 of it on the globe. A review of Cream's London reunion concert at Wednesday's calendar incorrectly referred to blues musician Skip James' song, I'm So Glad, as I'm Glad. Ladies and gentlemen, I told you it would have a theme because it's a recurring feature. It does, and it is.
Los Angeles Dog Trainer Corrections for you.
Now back to New Orleans and Marsha Ball.
I've seen maybe, 100, 200 of your shows.
And played a few of those.
We won't talk about that. That happened during the drunk zone.
Oh.
Not mine, but the audience's.
Yeah.
Yeah. But whether it's a really quiet, wrapped, full jazz club like what was happening last night, or a raucous, noisy joint like Jimmy's packed to the rafters with sweaty, drinking college kids.
Swaying sweaty bodies.
You seem to just have a great time on stage every time I see you. Is that right?
It is. Oh, yeah. Let me tell you. You pegged it. I am thrilled to be sitting where I'm sitting. And I mean that when I'm in an airplane on my way to New York City or Australia or wherever, or in the van with a map on my lap trying to find my way out of St. Louis, or any or at the piano here or last night or in the park or looking across at Dr. John on another piano, learning more in 5 minutes than I could have learned in the last year just by watching.
Mm.
You were talking about the way people attack the piano earlier.
Yeah.
I love to look at the hands of the piano players that I get to watch and how remarkable they are. It was watching Alan Toussaint on one piano and Dr. John on the other night. And Toussaint has these wonderful big hands, graceful hands, and he flourishes. He's got in his left hand. He's playing and he's rolling. And it's these beautiful flourishes. And then Mac, you don't even see there's movement. It's like all the, he's got short fingers and all the movement seems to be internal. In the chords and everything, it's like there's an octave and you know it's all inside there and very dense, fun to watch.
I hadn't seen Mac as Dr. John for listeners, and I had not gotten a close look at. I had Alan here doing one of these shows last year and got to watch his hands, but it's nice to know that people with short fingers can actually, because I'm cursed with, you know, as my wife calls them, little sausages. I don't think she means that as a compliment, but I don't have the nerve to ask.
You know, Toussaint was at his gig the other day, was crediting a teacher that he had when he was young with giving him tints. And I know that probably 80% of the audience had no idea what he was talking about, giving him tints. I'm sure what he meant was...
Oh, tenths.
Giving him tenths. And you know, that's dry... They give him that stuff, or just you know, I had to laugh because
Giving him tents.
Giving him tents.
Well, that's one thing I could never do. I watch you guys who can play tents. And
you got to roll them, Pete.
Booker did that, right?
Yeah.
Because he couldn't do them either. When did you start being a leader?
Well, I was in a band in Baton Rouge that I joined. And then in Austin, after we moved to Austin in 1970, we had a living room band, but then I joined another band, and that established me. It was the progressive country band that established me as a performer in Austin. But I joined that band, and I was with people who were more established than I was in Austin musically and in every way. And so that was great. It was a great opportunity. And then I joined another band. By that time, I realized that I did want to lead. Two things happened. I knew I wanted to say where we were going musically, and I was pregnant. And so I knew I had to say where we were going and when, and that woman over there holding the baby is going with us, because it's my band. and it's my baby. So I started my own band really in about 1974. I formed a band. Didn't tell him I was pregnant when I hired him. And by saying that, though, I have to say that I've always gained so much from the performers that I've had in my bands. And really, especially for the next probably 7 years, I would just hire the most interesting musicians I could find and then take as much information from them as I could in terms of style. I had a band that would play, our first song of the night would be Scrapple from the Apple, would be a Charlie Parker instrumental. And then we'd do maybe Big River by Johnny Cash. And then we'd do I'll Be Doggone by Smokey Robinson. And, our crazy medley, which I may have told you before, was Crazy Arms by Ray Price, Crazy by Willie Nelson, Crazy 'Cause I Love You by Spade Cooley, and I Go Crazy by James Brown. And it was fun. And these guys could sing, and they all played their instruments well. And so I learned a lot. But by 1980, I decided I wanted it to be R&B. I wanted to start writing it. The piano was starting to catch up. I could do more than play just rhythm, which for a long time, in terms of what equipment was available, there wasn't an audible piano available to me.
You couldn't take one of these 7-foot Yamahas.
No, and I could take a spin it, but amplifying it was still a challenge.
Yeah.
So as electric pianos seemed to catch up with electric guitars a little better in the 80s, and I hired a bunch of, once again, more experienced guys than me in the R&B field, that's when I really started moving into what I'm doing now.
The joy that you project on stage never seems to be gainsaid, to use the English term, by any sense that I've ever had of you complaining about how hard it is to be a chick on the road.
I've always felt two things. Somewhat well chaperoned and well surrounded by my security. My guys have always, in terms of any kind of weirdness or threat, on the part of lecherous club owners or whatever you might say, I just send the bass player in to get the money if it got down to that, there was always a little bit of that, you're always running into that in every business that you're in, a little bit of lechery but it comes from the same kind of person that would practice it in any field.
Mm-hmm.
So, I've always also credited every woman that went before me who struggled harder than I did to open some of those doors. People like Irma Thomas and Etta James and Bonnie Raitt, who really has been a torchbearer, and Emmy Lou Harris and Dolly Parton, and women who are speaking their mind, playing their music, talented, strong people. Rory Block, people who maybe aren't the household word that these other people are, but who are just immensely talented. And you don't always get fame or fortune in proportion to your talent. In fact, you rarely do. It's more common. So you just work hard as you can. And if you love it like I love it, then it's a pleasure too.
Could I make a request?
Oh, yeah.
Foreclose on the House of Love?
Sure. Sure. This was written by John Lee Sanders. I have to tell you about this guy. He came out of, I think Jackson, Mississippi at one point, spent some time in North Louisiana. Now he's in Oakland. He's a great player. He plays saxophone. He plays piano. He is a choir guy in a big church in Oakland. He's very involved with that. And that's what you hear in his music. You hear the spiritual side of John Lee Sanders. But this is his secular
side.
Material here.
Yes, the apologies of the week continue. 3 days after it was reported he was involved in a domestic dispute that triggered a 911 call from a 29-year-old woman in his Washington apartment, U.S. Representative Don Sherwood of Pennsylvania apologized for causing his family and supporters, quote, pain and embarrassment. I'm truly sorry. Now I have work to do. I'm going to continue to work hard for the people of the 10th District and begin the healing process with my family. 64-year-old Sherwood did not explain his relationship with the woman or say why she was in his apartment. He has called her a casual acquaintance. Dateline Vista, California, former city of Escondido planning commissioner pleaded guilty to identity theft, burglary, and manufacturing methamphetamine in his landscaping business. Bruce Martin Quick, I'll say, told the judge he would surrender May 13th to begin a jail sentence. Quick served on the planning commission for 5 years, resigned after his arrest. First, I want to apologize to the city of Escondido for any embarrassment I've caused, he wrote in a statement. Also to my wife, who was pulled into this due to no fault of her own, and my two sons, who also have been deeply affected by my actions. He also apologized to other members of his family who were hurt through any of the illegal activities. The Detroit Pistons fan facing the most serious charges in connection with the November brawl at the Palace was sentenced this week. Brian Jackson pleaded no contest to the charge that he threw a chair during the melee at the end of a Detroit, Indiana game. I got caught up in something I shouldn't have been caught up in, he explained about the chair throwing. I'm very remorseful, Your Honor. He also apologized to the Pistons, the Pacers, and his family. Dateline Las Vegas. Internet company T-ShirtHell.com used to be the home to the most offensive T-shirts on the Internet, with shirts that made light of everything from 9/11 to the recent tsunami. Now, founder, owner, and president Aaron Schwartz has decided to take down the most offensive shirts in his inventory, removing the entire Worse Than Hell category from his website. A lot of people were needlessly hurt and upset by the shirts on our website, Schwartz said, and for that, I want to apologize. Now back to Marsha Ball. People think of you as a New Orleans performer at this point in time, even though you're an Austinian.
Well, you know, people think of Dr. John as a New Orleans performer, and mm-hmm. he's lived in New York for 40 years.
Is that true?
Well, yeah.
I didn't know that. He's always here.
Well, he's here when you're here. Oh. You know, it's Jazz Fest and the fun times, like me. Mm. But no, you know, and he may, like me, still have family here. Mm. But, in fact, I noticed one of the things that was written down here about me said I was an honorary Louisianan. Well, let me clarify a couple of things.
You were born Louisianan.
And this is what's confusing. I was actually born in Texas. I was born across the state line in Orange, Texas, because the hospital was there. But Vinton, Louisiana, 8 miles away, is my home. My name is Mouton. My family name is Mouton. And I grew up a Mouton. I went off to LSU a Mouton. I married my first husband, Bob Ball, and became Marsha Ball. But if you look up Mouton, you know, if you look up Cajun in the dictionary, there's going to be a picture of a Mouton there.
And what does Mouton mean?
Well, it means sheep in French.
Of course, yeah.
En français, but it's a very common name in Lafayette. And it's a big family, and that's my family. So
they just left the Rothschild off, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. I'm making up for that. I'm heavily invested in that.
And what took you to Austin in the first place?
Well, at the time, which was 1970, the late 60s and early 70s, two things were happening. One was that it was a liberal outpost, an oasis in the South. And if you were going to live in the South at all, I mean, it was... Even New Orleans wouldn't work. It was conservative and dangerous for long hairs and just didn't have the kind of sensibility. Austin was truly the Third Coast at that point. Mm-hmm. The posters that were coming from the Vulcan Gas Company looked like Family Dog and Fillmore posters, and they were doing the same things. They were having Johnny Winter and Lightnin' Hopkins playing gigs together. And so we were getting that in Baton Rouge. And we had a lot of friends who were running the roads back and forth and who were moving there. But we set out to go to San Francisco in 1970. And we got to Austin to visit and had car trouble. And 3 days later, by the time the car was done, we had a house. We had jobs. We had fallen in love with Austin and we never left.
Hmm. I mean, San Francisco was so over by then anyway.
Well, the summer of love was definitely over by August of 68, yeah. apparently, yeah. or 67 even. But Yeah, I think truly for me, I was 20, and it was Austin was far enough from Mom and them, you know. And it worked out well because when I first started playing music and traveling with the music, I could just come back over here. I still somehow had friends in Baton Rouge. I mean, even if I didn't have a reputation, at least I had a house. I had somebody I could stay with when we played the clubs over here. So we immediately turned around and came back and played in Lake Charles, Lafayette, Baton Rouge, Hammond, and New Orleans. Those were our first road gigs.
Mm. I first went to Austin, I guess, about 2 years after you got there. No, sorry, 4 years after you got there. And I was sort of, having been in San Francisco during that time that you, because I'm older than you, aspired to be there, I was real impressed with Austin. As we would say now, blue spot in the Red Sea.
Yes, yeah. Still is. And it was a glorious place at that time, still kind of a small town. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a joke now. You should have been here in the 70s. But it really was a very special place. And it remains so, really, in many ways. But and something was happening there because between 1968 and 1972, everybody that we consider to be the icons of Austin music and carrying it into the future converged or reconverged there. Willie came back, you know, by 1972 he was back. But before that, people came to school there and never left. Angela Straley came. Lou Ann Barton came to play music. Jimmy Vaughn came down. Stevie came down. Derek O'Brien came to school there to and never left. Denny Freeman came. Paul Ray, all the Lubbock guys, Butch Hancock, Jimmy Gilmore. Sean Colvin came down in the early 70s with a little band from Indiana called the Dixie Diesels and played down there. Jerry Jeff Walker, Asleep at the Wheel. It just, the music scene happened. And then here comes Doug Somm up from San Antonio with his unerring sense of musical direction. You know, he knows where it's happening. And he brought Jerry Wexler with him. And so then Jerry shined this other kind of spotlight, recorded Willie's Atlantic album, Doug's Atlantic album, looked at my little band, Freedom the Fire Dogs, and made a demo tape for us. Tony Joe White, you know, Freddie Fender's hanging around because Doug's there. It was just a magical time and place.
I've always been curious about this. Austin is the only music scene that seems to have happened in the shadow of a state capital. And it's always seemed like the weirdest, you know, weirdest place for a scene like that to be going on is right under the noses of the legislature.
You know, Austin, though, what I loved about it was that it was the kind of town where you could hang out with the governor. I mean, especially when Ann Richards was the governor.
Yeah.
But there, it seemed to me at that time to be a real classless society. In the nicest possible way.
In the way that Americans like to think that this is a classless society.
Yeah, and like I said, you seem to be able to run with the politicians. And in fact, it's the most benefit-intensive town. A friend of mine said New Orleans isn't like that. If somebody gets sick in Austin, if somebody's house floods or burns, if there's any kind of a charitable organization based on anything, diseases or needing instruments for kids, any politician that's running for office, let's get a band and throw a benefit.
Mm.
It happens weekly, tri-weekly.
Mm.
There's a fundraiser, which says two things. One is that there's a lot of need, and the other thing is that people in Austin know that they can turn to the musician for one thing.
Yeah.
And for me, many of those events are less about raising a bunch of money because typically if you've been real sick, the money you're going to raise at one of those is a drop in the bucket. But it's an outpouring of love that Austin's ready to give.
You were living there during the time of George W. Bush as governor, yes?
Oh, yeah.
Memories of that time?
Oh, yeah, well, you know, the same only only less so, I guess.
You know, he didn't start a war with Arkansas, is what you're saying.
No, but he could have. And, yeah, we were in a way relieved when he was elected president, because at least he was unleashed on the entire nation and removed from us, although he left us with Rick Perry. And in my theory at that time and through this next election, the last election was, you know, the people that vote for him are going to get what they deserve. Unfortunately, the rest of us are going to get what they deserve, too. And so we have. And you know my slogan now is 2 more years. And then, of course, Kinky Friedman's running for governor.
I know.
On his campaign slogan, how hard can it be?
Second best campaign slogan ever, second only to an old friend of mine who was with this improv group, The Committee,
yeah,
and who ran for mayor of San Francisco. His name was John Brent, and his platform was, anything you want. Would you do a instrumental piece for us?
I did one last. I did that Zydeco Boogaloo last night. It's kind of a... It's certainly not sensitive. Not much of what I do is. Okay, never do it. Let me do it again.
My wrists hurt. Just
I think
listen.
I did it in the wrong key. Let me do it again.
Zydeco Boogaloo?
Clifton Chenier.
Oh, man.
And every other, it's one of those like Hot Tamale Baby that has run through the entire group.
That's great. So a couple of questions I want to ask before we wrap it up. Do you teach?
No. For a lot of reasons. I take.
You do still, not give, you take.
I'm still taking from my friends, but and time.
Mm. Yeah.
If I felt like I could impart theory and I mean, I'm very willing to show anybody anything that I can, but I've just never felt I had the technique to impart.
And your significant other,
yes,
is a I have not yet been to your place and not yet seen a lot of his stuff, but
a near miss this last time. Yes. Yeah.
But I hear raves about his work, and he's a painter.
He's a terrific painter,
and the fact that both of you live to normal people might seem challenging creative lives, does that must work in your favor, that the two of you understand.
It's a wonder we're not starving to death.
Well,
as you well know.
Yeah.
Two artists together.
Yeah, exactly.
But it works really well. And my mother, who's listening in right now, said she's glad we found one another and didn't mess up two perfectly normal people. And it really does work that well. And Gordon has been a musician, too. He was a rock and roller in the 50s in Austin. You know, he was had one of the first little rock and roll bands called the Nightlights in the 50s. And one of the first Fender electric guitars in Austin, you know. And so he knows about that. He still plays. He still takes guitar lessons. Mm. So not only does he understand that, but he's also very well-grounded in what he does and in his life. You know, he's not dependent on me for anything. He doesn't, we appreciate this about one another. If I stand up at 10 o'clock at night and say, I'm going to the Saxon pub, he doesn't say, you can't go, and I don't say, you have to go with me.
Mm-hmm.
And we appreciate that about one another a whole lot.
That's a big one.
Yeah.
When we're here for Jazz Fest and Judith is here with me, it's the same thing. You know, I'll say, I'm going out to see a lot of music. She says, well, I'll be here.
Right. Have a nice night.
Have a nice night. I'll be here when you get back.
Right.
And I didn't know, you mentioned you used to play guitar. Do you ever play guitar again?
No. I mean, I can still play, like I said about reading music, about the same half dozen chords I played then. I can struggle through a folk song or two, but I got one. I was about 14, and I hadn't heard any folk music in my life. And my aunt had a friend who was a kindergarten teacher in Houston and a folk singer in coffee houses at night. And she came to visit my aunt and played Puff the Magic Dragon on the piano because she didn't have her guitar with her. And I was totally fascinated by the whole idea. And so,
you know, it was a drug song, right?
I didn't know at the time.
Oh, okay.
No, I thought it was alcohol. I was heavily into alcohol at the time. I was only 14. But
why does folk singer / kindergarten teacher sound like almost a natural combination?
I know. I know, especially singing that song to her children. So that's when I was aware of that as an interest. Mm. And I talked. I begged a guitar out of my parents and learned my little chords. But I was just way not a singer.
Really?
No. I was in the back, you know, in the back of the bus going show do and show be do while Donna was singing in the still of the night.
And where is Donna today?
Oh, Georgia.
Okay. Could you do one more to take us out?
Yeah. Let me think again, though. What should it be?
While you're thinking, bless you.
I'm sorry, this is the
morning cough. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I said 300 nights a year, is that about right?
No. We play about 125 or 30 gigs a year.
Oh, well, that's civilized.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that means that there's a little more traveling involved. Yeah. As you were asking about Gordon and I, you know, the other thing that we have that works for us is we've been together for 22 years, but I've only been there for 11
of them. So. Yeah, I know that deal. And it's like always a lovely homecoming.
Yeah. Yeah. The dog jumps up to here.
Oh, well, that's good. You don't get, who are you?
Right.
Our dog goes all moody on us, you know.
Oh, like, yeah.
Where you been?
Yeah.
Oh, now I'm supposed to be friendly?
Right.
And there's a day of, like, he'll sleep downstairs, like, no, I'm not going to come up with you guys.
Oh, man. That's he's working you.
Yeah, that's that?
That's what we call PDS, which is porch dog syndrome. My bass player, Don, used to have a parrot. And, man, that bird would totally forget him over a weekend and bite him and, you know, treat him like hell until Friday, and then he'd leave again.
Oh, that's a doomed relationship.
Yeah. Buddy was not a buddy.
But not a buddy.
For my spoon and fork, and when it's time to cut my steak, I make sure my knife is sharp. And if I want to hang a picture, I reach for a hammer and nail. And when it's time to clean the floor, I get out the mop and pail. I don't like to waste my time. I make sure I've got the right tool for the job. I want a car that goes real fast. When I listen to music on the radio to blast. If my house is burning down, get the fire truck there real quick. And take me to the finest doctor, y'all, if I start to feeling sick. I want an icebox that stays cold. A stove that gets real hot. The right tool for the job. The right tool for the job. That never nicks. I want a fan that keeps me cool at night. A man that always loves me right.
That's going to end this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the American Forces Network, and down on the east coast of North America via the
shortwave giant WBCQ around the world via the internet at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available as a free download at www.audible.com/LeShow and on Channel 108 on Sirius Satellite Radio. My thanks to Marsha Ball and Drew at Piety Street Studios in New Orleans for helping with today's broadcast. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.